Welcome to Fate's Wide Wheel, a Quantum Leap podcast with Sam and Dennis. We are coming to you from our top secret headquarters at Project Quantum Leap, but you can find us online at fwwquantumleappod.com or follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Fate's Wide Wheel. And please do us a favor by hitting the subscribe button on iTunes.
And such, but right.
Hey, bear with us.
Bear with us.
Hello, everybody.
There's no bear in the room, I promise.
No. Never mind.
Thank you, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Fate's Wide Wheel. We are here at Project Quantum Leap, and the heater, as you may be able to hear, is going full on because it is under 30 degrees outside.
Yeah, we say our top secret headquarters in the intro as a little gimmick, but we're in Chicago.
Yeah.
And in Chicago, it's 30 below, and we have somewhat primitive recording equipment right now, so please bear with us. I'm sure Sam will do his best to punch up the sound however you can.
Absolutely.
That's his end.
Speaking of which, we did get a little feedback about that at one point, and so I have been raising the level a bit, so... Yeah, you shouldn't have to crank up your listening devices to full volume to hear everything. So we do always appreciate that feedback. And
that was Russell Knight who gave us that feedback. Who, by the way, his Facebook profile is a picture of Henry Cavill from Man of Steel, but with the mustache.
With the stash.
With the stash, yeah.
Russell, well done, sir.
That is... You know, I would buy that Superman. I would buy more in the 1970s, but I would buy that Superman.
Yeah, why not? Wasn't Burt Reynolds actually in the running at one point? I don't know. Maybe he was in the running to play Han Solo. I know that much.
That makes more sense.
Yeah, it does. Who knows? Anyway, so we're here today to discuss Blind Faith. We are cruising through the second season. This episode was directed by David G. Finney, written by Scott Shepard. It aired November the 1st, 1989. Our leap date is February the 6th, 1964, and Sam has leapt into Andrew Ross.
The Ray Charles of classical piano.
Indeed.
Let's read the TV guide description.
What do we got?
Sam, Scott Bakula, plays it again as a famous concert pianist who has to prevent the murder of a friend, and the fact that he's supposed to be blind is noteworthy.
Well, all right, then.
All right.
Noteworthy.
Is noteworthy.
Because he's...
Jesus H. I thought, oh, that's kind of a, like, someone, like, just, like, quickly wrote that one. But there was a pun in there I did not even see. Well played, TV Guide.
How about that, TV Guide? We're coming out of What Price Gloria, and the opening sort of narration scene stuff is still there rather than the Saga Cell, which will be, you know, become more prevalent.
Please get here, Saga Cell.
Yeah, these opening narrations, and the funny thing is I genuinely feel like, not so much this one, but for Good Morning Peoria, which is the next episode we'll talk about, there's almost a wince in Scott Bakula's voice as I gotta read this crap.
Yeah, because it's probably like the last thing they do from when the episode or whatever, like weeks later they bring him in, and you know.
Yeah, and they're fine. They're totally serviceable. But one of the things that I'm noticing more and more is just how there are certain 80s television kind of things, whether it's a button on a scene before you go to commercial or you know, just things that kind of feel a little cheesy sometimes, and I think get in the way of a good episode. And there are actually a couple of moments within Blind Faith that happens, so I look forward to talking about that a little bit, because there's a couple of moments where I'm just sort of like, oh, you really didn't have to do that, but
yes, I had another thought. I think it's somewhat different, but yes, I feel like this episode, the serial killer trope totally steeped in the 80s, and we'll get into that.
Absolutely.
Here in a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there's a thing, and we'll get into it in a little bit. Like, it bugged me about the plot of this episode, and then when I put it through the filter of how we saw serial killers at that time in the 1980s, it was like, oh, okay, I got it.
Yeah.
I see how the writing got us to this point.
Boy. Oh boy. Speaking of which, we do get an oh boy moment as Sam is sitting there at the piano. He's finished a beautiful concerto, we're sure, and the audience is applauding. And he, of course, is scared out of his wits that he's not going to know what to do. And he goes off stage, which is where we first meet Michelle, played by Cynthia Bain. I thought this was kind of interesting. According to her IMDb page, for the past, you know, 15 years or so, she's been working almost exclusively as an acting coach and performance consultant for, like, children's television shows.
Fantastic.
Yeah, which I thought was really kind of cool. And it's interesting, too, because she got her start when she was very young. She should have been, like, 14 or 15 years old, I think. So she's got some experience in that realm. But she also did a lot of television coming up. She was in, like, Chips and Knots Landing.
Chips!
You know, Highway to Heaven. The biblical version of Quantum Leap.
Yes.
And so Sam has to go back out for his encore.
Yeah.
And he sits down and launches into Chopsticks.
One thing interesting to note, this is where the previous episode, What Price Galeria, kind of implies that this is the first episode that flat out confirms that Sam's body fully leaps and it's not just his mind. Because even though Andrew Ross is blind, Sam obviously has retained his eyesight.
Yeah.
Noteworthy.
Yeah. And it's funny too.
Noteworthy. We're in a joke of the episode.
Oh man. You should write for TV Guide.
I'm good.
So one thing also that I think is noteworthy is that his dog Chopin clearly notices that there's a difference here with Andrew, and I think that goes back to what we've seen since the first season, where animals can see Al, and you know, and so it makes sense that this scene, iDog, which clearly would be so, you know, such a huge and important part of Andrew's life, notices the difference. But yeah, I like this scene. You know, it's fun. Sam goes back, starts playing Chopstick. At first, the audience, you could tell they're sort of like, "What is going on?" And then they're in on the joke, and they laugh and they applaud, and it works out for him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a nice, cute little moment. And you know, he plays it off well, and yeah, takes his bow.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then we quickly move on to outside. Yeah, they're walking on the street pretty quickly.
Yeah, and you know, we really, right away, we get a wonderful look into the relationship between Michelle and Andrew. You know, obviously as filtered through Sam's eyes. Can I say that? And
forgive the accidental puns throughout.
It's gotta be hard.
Yeah.
So Michelle, Michelle's a nice character. Cynthia, you know, plays her well. She's sweet, sensitive, young, in nursing school, needs to get home to hit the books. And they have this moment outside of the newsstand. Actually, before that, there's the... he gets to the newsstand, and he's looking at the newspaper to see what time...
Yeah, he zooms in to see... Yeah.
And so she asks what he's doing, and he mentions something about the newspaper stand, and she's like, "How did you know that?" And of course, he plays it off with a... I could hear the crumpling of the newspapers or whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But then she takes out his pocket watch, which has, like, Braille on it, so he's able to tell the time. But, of course, she lets him know what time it is, so he doesn't actually have to, which is nice. But one of my favorite shots actually happens here, and it feels, in some ways, while easy and simple, it came off to me as a little more sophisticated, especially for establishing scenes of Quantum Leap. Like, I feel like it's something that they usually do pretty well, but this was really nice. Because it's not made too much of, but there's that pan over the crumpled newspaper on the ground, which says, like, "Third woman strangled in the park."
Yes.
And I just thought that was such a really wonderful, like, economy of storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
Because now, here's this thing.
Yeah.
And it's great because it's not like it's been the entire conversation between the two of them as they've left. You know, they're not just talking about, "Oh, did you hear about the third woman strike?" You know, there's not this clunky expository conversation. Instead, we just get this nice little shot of the newspaper.
And what's wonderful is, and this is, you know, gone away because, like, print newspapers more and more.
Yeah.
less, but it's like you get that wonderful economy of storytelling with dates and stuff with time travel shows. It'll be interesting, like 50 years from now, when they're doing time travel shows and they're coming back to our present day. Like, how are you going to get those shots? People looking on their phone or something.
So, but yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, today, Sam would just pick up his iPhone X and look at it. Mm-hmm. It would unlock, and he'd know the time, when, where, everything.
Absolutely, yeah.
Whose friends were.
Yeah.
If anyone's sending him naked pictures.
Yeah. Time travel shows are going to be a lot less interesting in the future.
There
is... I'm not sure if it's this one or if it's the next day scene. There is a shot in this episode where they show the Twin Towers. Which, actually, they haven't even started to be built yet.
Interesting. Oh, yeah, yeah. That's right. We're in 1960. Yeah. No,
yeah.
No,
yeah. But hey, we can...
Ah, right. What
are you gonna do?
Which is funny, considering that the episode was actually shot on a Hollywood backlot, but for establishing shots, they showed us the skyline.
The skyline up there. Yeah, that's going to slip in.
Which is also kind of interesting when you think about it, because if I'm not mistaken, for Double Identity, when they use the establishing shots of New York, those are all, like, that's all stock footage. And it was period appropriate. So it's interesting that
something slipped
in. That in this one, yeah, they didn't get
slipped
that.
In through there.
Yeah.
I don't know. Just reminded me, did you ever watch the U.S. version of Life on Mars?
I don't know. I don't think I did. I only watched the British version, but I didn't see all of it.
Because the U.S. version, obviously, they move it over to New York, and they actually make great use of the Twin Towers.
Oh, nice.
Because it's present day going back to the mid-1970s.
Yeah.
And actually, in the U.S. version, the first really huge visual cue that he really big visual cue that he gets that he is back in time is he looks up and he realizes he is standing in the shadow of the Twin Towers. And that series was in 2008, so that was just, you know, 7 years after 9/11. So
is it good? I've seen the British version. I thought it was exceptionally well done. I think John Sim is great, and that's one of the things about the show that was such a big draw, was him as the lead. And so that, to me, I feel like the burden of that on someone else would not be easy.
I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
The U.S. version only lasted 17 episodes, which is more episodes than the British version, but the U.S. version is considered a failure because it only lasted one season. In hindsight, I'm glad it only lasted one season because their answer at the end is drastically different from the U.K. version, and that was the showrunner's plan all along.
Yeah.
And had I watched the show for 5 seasons and we got to the ending that we got to, I would have been annoyed.
Oh, sure, sure. Yeah, it's interesting.
I'll tell you off mic. I don't give any spoilers.
Right.
That being said, I think it is available on DVD, the entire series, like 17 episodes. It is definitely worth your time.
Nice.
The answer, the last 5 minutes of the series, because they actually got to, they knew they were going to get canceled, so they actually got to resolve it.
Nice.
The last 5 minutes are what they are. But I think the 17 and 9/10 episodes or 16 and 9/10 are definitely worth your time.
Nice. Okay. Okay. Yeah, I'll definitely have to check it out. Like I said, I like the British version, but I never finished it, so I should go back and do that at some point. There was that age where Netflix still has a lot of content, don't get me wrong, but I mean, you could find just about anything you wanted on Netflix, and both of them were on Netflix at one point, and now I don't think either one of them are, which is too bad. But anyway,
back to another time travel show,
right?
Quantum Leap, Blind Faith.
There's this moment where so Michelle basically drops him off, or drops herself off, if you will. And there's this moment where he's trying to figure out where he lives, and then we get our French lady with her dogs named Josephine and Napoleon come out, and it's kind of a weird bit, and it's what I was talking about earlier with just it feels sort of like there's nothing wrong with it, but it's kind of just unnecessary. And even to the point where it seems like the actor is having difficulty navigating those stairs and the heels that she has to wear, which also is like, why the hell is she walking her dogs in these like 6-inch heels?
I mean, taking her dogs on a long walk, I mean, they've established we're after midnight now, or we're close to midnight.
Right.
And so one,
it's like, I could see, I mean, if you got to walk your dogs, dogs are, you know, finicky, temperamental, maybe you got to take them on a walk. Sure. Why are you dressed like that?
Right?
After midnight.
I mean, hey, you do and you, then,
but for sure. Yeah, but like that early in the morning, that late at night, when I go to walk Jessica Jones, which is our dog, like when I take her down for her final pee of the night, many nights I'm walking out in just my bathrobe. I don't care. I mean, we're just walking. We're taking 10 steps out to the grass for her to pee. And
sure.
Then we're walking right back in. If anybody's, I mean, I'm covered up.
Right.
You know, it's a big furry bathrobe, you know.
Yeah.
But if anybody sees me, I don't care.
Yeah.
I think you get great insight into someone's soul by what they wear to walk their dog either early in the morning or late at night.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But anyway, so...
So, yeah, and I feel like the only reason for this moment, really, especially because of what happens later, is to play off the gag that Sam is checking her out as she walks away, only Andrew can't see. And it's just... I don't know. I don't want to be hypercritical of it, because at the end of the day, it's like, yeah, whatever. But it was just... It was one of those things that I sort of was like, okay, this is because the television show was... written 30 years ago, as opposed to being, because I just don't feel like you'd see that today, unless it was a sitcom.
Yeah, you know? I mean, it's a visual joke to reinforce that Andrew's supposed to be blind, but Sam is not. But also, it is kind of out of character for Sam.
To check her out that way, you're right. And the thing is because we get the, you know, the reinforcement of the fact that Andrew's blind and that Sam is not, just moments later when we get the mirror shot, it's sort of like... Okay, you know, do what you gotta, but it's fine. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, the mirror shot, we get our first look at Andrew, and there is a interesting little sight goof that, you know, normally we don't talk about a whole lot of this stuff, because, you know, whatever, but it's just interesting to me, because the mirror image, Andrew is there, and then all of a sudden you actually see Scott Bakula's shoulder creep into the mirror image as well.
Mm-hmm.
Which I guess gives you a little insight into the fact that how they did that.
Speaking of Psycho, something I totally missed from What Price Gloria last week, because Betsy never finished watching the episode with me the week before, so we were watching like that very last scene of What Price Gloria, and they do this shot where Scott Bakula sits on the couch as Samantha, and that like the camera actually like pans around following Buddy locking the door, and then they show the cabinet in the mirror on the other side, and in the mirror it's the actress in there. And what watching it this last time, something I had never caught before, like as the camera starts to pan around, Scott Bakula is lounging on the couch and the camera doesn't quite get away from him, but you can clearly see him start to get up off the couch.
No way.
So that the actress can replace him. And like,
that's
once you see it, it's like, oh, it's so obvious. Like, he's jumping off the couch.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, you got to think too that, you know, almost 30 years ago when somebody's in the editing bay and they're looking at this, they're thinking to themselves, ah, somebody's going to watch it once. Maybe they'll catch it in reruns. You know, who cares?
Mm-hmm.
But now you could just imagine someone's like fright if they saw that and were like, oh, we have to get rid of that. Like, they're going to pause this. They're going to rewind it on their streaming device. They're going, you know, and so you, there are obviously still flubs like that that get made, but they're very far and few between these days.
Mm-hmm. But anyway, so we get the mirror shot with Andrew and Scott,
And then we meet Pete the cop.
Mm-hmm.
Peter O'Shannon.
Yeah.
And he immediately starts complaining about the fact that these four mop-topped guys from England are, you know, raising hell with the cops having to do extra duty.
The security, because they're going to be playing
Ed Sullivan.
The Ed Sullivan Show.
That's right. So we're firmly established. This is just a few days before the Beatles would invade America.
Mm-hmm.
Which is nice. And one of the reasons why I sort of liked this little kiss with history, if you will, more than some of the others, is it's not as in your face. Again, it's almost like that newspaper shot earlier. It's more just sort of like, this is where you are and this is what's going on, but it's not about that. We're not going to make a moment of that necessarily. And even with some of the stuff that happens later in the episode, I never feel like it's, I don't know. It feels more like a brush with history as opposed to in your face, like you're teaching Chubby Checker the twist.
Spoilers. When would they do that? Yeah.
But anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Absolutely.
And to jump back to the mirror shot, we were talking about this off mic before we started recording. It's interesting, Chopin, like he's another character of the show. Like he's so great with the gags they get out of him. But it's clear, like, when he looks in the mirror, he sees his owner,
right,
Andrew. But then when he looks back, he sees Sam.
Yeah.
And I just thought that
right.
that's interesting.
It is. Well, and you know, it's funny too, because there's this developing relationship between Sam and Chopin, and like after Pete gives him the peanuts or whatever, like Sam's admonishing him for not spitting out the shells.
Yeah. So,
and you're right, he's very much a character, and there's not only that established relationship that he clearly has with Andrew, but there's this developing relationship with Sam, and it is kind of cute. And there are some gags that they get out of it that are pretty nice. And there's even, you know, one of the big obstacles of the episode occurs because of Chopin, in a way, if you think about it. Anyway, so Pete goes to do his beat, and Sam has, you know...
And Pete also, like, he makes reference... Or no, it's the next day where Pete makes reference to the serial killer thing going on.
Yeah. So, and at this point, so, you know, Peter leaves. Sam gets his first visit from Al, which, you know, Al took his time getting there, of course. But, yeah, Al comes in, and... there's conversation.
My favorite is when Al recounts the story of seeing someone in Tijuana.
I believe. Oh, yeah.
Avita de la Villetita.
Yeah.
Who used to play certain music with her toes. And then other body parts. And then she would finish the show by doing the Star Spangled Banner in 40 different languages. But this is where we establish that there is no sheet music, because that's what Sam is looking for.
Right.
He's blind.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he plays by ear, which is, makes him even more remarkable, really, when you think about it. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I guess I don't know much about how...
I don't know. I was going to ask you, because you're a musician, you play guitar. I dabble. I know, like, three-chord country. I can, you know,
sure.
I can strum some songs.
Yeah.
But you are a much more experienced musician. Like, I, as far as, like, playing by ear like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's not something that I could ever just do innately. There have certainly been times when if I listen to a song a few times and there's a certain thing that sticks out, you know, I might be able to kind of figure out a chord and then play around and figure out what comes next, or like a progression or something like that, but not in any way just sort of like hearing a song a few times and like, oh yeah, I know how to play that.
Yeah.
And I knew people, and I've known people that could do that. A guy I went to school with, who actually has become quite famous these days. We were at a party at his place, and two of us just kind of snuck off to his room so we could play guitar. And he had just gotten an electric guitar, because he'd been in the service for a while, and so he just had gotten out, and he was going to school, and, you know, he had a little extra money, so he bought a guitar. And he put on a Radiohead album, and he picks up the guitar, and he starts, like, playing along. And I'm just thinking to myself, oh, he must know this song. And he's just like, oh, I just learned this. And I was like, what? It sounds like spot on, 100% perfect. So I've known people that can do that. And I had a buddy of mine when I was in high school that was usually pretty good at identifying things. Like, he could, and I don't know if it was necessarily because, like, he heard it and he just knew it, or it was because he had so much experience playing guitar that he heard a chord and he could be like, oh yeah, that's an E minor. You know what I mean? Yeah. Anyway, I mean, I could definitely never do that. For me, I don't know. It's a much more blue collar sort of, like, I know this chord, and I know that oftentimes it's paired with this chord, sort of thing. But yeah, it's interesting for Sam, especially because, again, some of the things. And it's not difficult because of the Swiss cheese brain, and clearly he doesn't know some of these things himself, and there's a bit that we find out later on in the episode, specifically, that it's like, oh, if he would have remembered this, it probably would have helped him feel a little bit more confident about all of this. But we do get the notion, as the show goes on, that Sam, you know, Sam can play music. And he can sing, and he can fight, and he can, like, there are things that he can do, because he knew these things before he started leaping around in time anyway. Mm-hmm.
But from this, we get, Andrew has to give another concert.
Yeah.
The following night.
Yep.
And we find out that Michelle is going to be strangled in Central Park after the concert.
Yeah.
Hence the plot and the obstacle. He has to play the concert. He has to get through that time period to...
Yeah.
To save Michelle from getting strangled in the park. Now, whether or not he really has to play the concert, I have issues with that, but we'll talk about that as we get closer to the concert.
Yeah, no, I look forward to hearing what you have to say.
Yeah, so we get this nice visual shot of Al disappearing through the imaging chamber door and Chopin trying to get through him.
Which is great, because Chopin, when he goes over to scratch at the floor where Al was just standing, there's already scratch marks on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
And in my head, I went, you know, it went all over the place, and I thought to myself, oh, maybe that's, like, Chopin's, like, a little scratching spot anyway. And more likely, it was just that they'd shot the scene a few times, and the floor got scratched up.
Yeah.
You know, but it was just kind of like, oh, okay, how about that? You know, it's already scratched up. But it is. It's a cute little moment. It's one of those things I was talking about with Chopin being such an important character. Mm-hmm. And then, speaking of important characters, we get introduced to Michelle's mom, Agnes. Because there's the scene.
That's right.
Because when you see Michelle, like, kind of taking her books out of the fire hose.
That's right. Yeah.
And like, clearly she was supposed to have been studying, but instead she was out with Andrew. And Mama does not approve.
No.
So that.
Yeah.
And Mama is played by Jennifer Rhodes, who is again, another one of those actors that she still works to this day in television. She was recently, like, on an episode of Grey's Anatomy or something. And, you know, she started in 1971, so, you know, 45-plus years of a career and hitting all of the major TV shows, as we've talked about, you know, before. I think, in some ways, is very effective. And if I can compare her to another mother character that we've recently had in the Americanization of Machiko, does a much better job of being sort of the villainous mother, you know, if you will, the Wicked Witch of the East, as Al calls her, or West, was it? Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I just, there was something about her that I liked more. Not that this show is about comparing, contrasting
the villainous mothers,
right?
Yeah.
But
what's interesting is, and I've observed this before, like watching the episode previously, but rewatching it this time. Michelle's mom reminds me so much of my high school girlfriend in the first part of college.
Oh, really?
Her mom.
Okay.
Just. Yes.
Yeah.
Just a very, very unpleasant person. I should say my high school girlfriend, she came from a broken home. Family had a lot of problems. Parents were divorced. But her and her mom, they would get in fights in front of me all the time. And her mom was like kind of mom, like frequently like threatened to like send her off to a children's home as a thing. Or they would get in fights in front of me, and then the mom would just turn to me in the middle of the fight. Tell her, Dennis, tell her.
Oh, wow.
Like try to get me over.
Oof.
Yeah.
That's awkward.
Yeah. And it, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and you do get the sense here that that Agnes would probably have no problem doing something very similar. Because, she, you know, immediately kind of launches into the investigation of where Michelle has been.
Mm-hmm.
And Michelle does, you know, lies to her. It says that she was out studying with her friends. And then Agnes calls her on it because she's already talked to those people. So, you know, there's all of a sudden there's this, okay, clearly there's not a lot of trust in this relationship, you know, on either end. You know, Michelle doesn't trust that she would be okay with Michelle making her own decisions, and Agnes doesn't trust Michelle to make right choices. And of course, Agnes launches into the guilt trip of, I'm just trying to make sure that you'll be able to take care of yourself, and that when your husband runs off on you and leaves you with a 4-year-old and a mouth to feed, that you don't have
it. It won't be just a concert, will it? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just sort of like, man, Agnes, you're basically just letting Michelle know that she ruined your life.
I hadn't thought about it that way.
But that she's, but mm-hmm. that Agnes is doing all of this for Michelle.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just kind of like, man, that kind of, oof.
You live your life in fear, so you keep everybody else living in fear. And
right.
The line that ends the scene, a fool's dreams may be dreams, but they also belong to a fool. I never heard that expression outside of this episode
yeah.
of television.
I know.
Okay.
No, it's not something.
If it's something I'm supposed to know, I've just never heard outside of.
Yeah, I don't know. It sounds like something that is out there maybe, but mm-hmm. I can't tell you where else.
Yeah. So we kind of, in this scene we establish not only is Michelle going to be strangled to death the next night, but we see like her day-to-day struggle of trying to go through nursing school, also trying to, they never really establish whether or not, Andrew and Michelle's relationship is romantic.
Yeah.
There are also a lot of talks of Michelle having told her mom about Andrew.
Right.
Just yet. So it's very heavily implied that they are at the start of a romantic relationship.
Yeah. But it feels very, very chaste right now and very sort of, you know, that clearly Michelle adores Andrew. But even, you know, like when she says goodbye to him, she kisses him on the cheek, you know, things like that. So you do get the idea that it's certainly towards the start of something, of whatever it might be, but that there's something very sort of pure about it, if you will. You know, this isn't like some sort of advanced romantic relationship where, you know, they're making out in the back seat of a car or whatever. I don't know.
Yes.
I don't know why I said that. Anyway. So this is what I was talking about earlier, because even though it's still very manipulative, Agnes does sort of shift her tone towards the end of the scene and becomes a little bit more sympathetic and about how, you know, she's wanting to provide and make sure that Michelle has a chance to go to nursing school and that she can take care of herself. And again, the way she gets there and even what she says in that moment feels a little manipulative still. It's also kind of it's a nice shift away from, you know, the overbearing, domineering mother that we got when Michelle walks in the door.
Mm-hmm. But also at the same time, very manipulative.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Absolutely. Because yeah, she even says like there'll be no Prince Charming to, you know, to take care of you or whatever.
I'm gonna smack you around. I'm gonna smack you around. Here, come here.
Yeah.
Let me love you.
Yep. Exactly. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
Al, Sam, one other thing we forgot to mention is Al is super excited that they are so close to the Beatles appearing on Ed Sullivan.
Oh yeah, he said he went out and got a long-haired wig or something.
To attract women the very next day.
That's interesting.
And
now we get the shot to Central Park.
Yes, of our French woman walking Josephine and Napoleon.
Mm-hmm.
She gets strangled.
And she gets strangled. Of course. And you would say, you talk about like those very 80s things, something just seems very 80s. It's just like that shot at the end of that scene of like seeing the rope come around her neck and like almost, not quite, but almost breaking the fourth wall and looking directly into the camera with her look of shock.
Yeah.
That is a very. Yes.
It's Murder, She Wrote, man.
Yes. Yeah. Murder. Yeah. That is a very 80s shot.
Yeah.
And so this is the thing, watching this episode and watching the scene, getting the whole, like, other 80s motif with serial killers, it, like, what really bugs me watching this is, like, Sam got there in plenty of time.
Right.
To save her.
Yeah.
Al got there in plenty of time to warn him.
Right.
And yet she gets killed.
Did Ziggy just not have the files? There's
no. Yeah, and so even in the next day when we going into the next scene where Sam is out on the street and the girls are gathering because the Beatles are outside.
Right.
The Ed Sullivan Theater.
That's a hotel. They're getting to their hotel.
Yeah. That's it. Okay. And he runs into Pete again, and Pete goes, "Yeah, they got another girl.
Yeah.
Last night." And Sam's just like, "Oh. Okay."
Right.
And, like, it doesn't bug him like it will bug him in future episodes, like, when he thinks that he could have saved a life and he didn't have the information in time. Like, he's like, oh, okay.
Right.
And it rolls over. And, you know, it's an hour television. You got, like, 42 minutes, you know, you can't.
Sure.
Whatever. But also, like, after watching the episode, like, dwelling on it, it also occurred to me, and we were talking about this earlier, is that in the 70s and 80s, there was, like, this bigger idea of a serial killer, and I was looking at some stuff online, and I read some stuff ranging saying that there weren't near as many serial killers back in the 80s as we thought they were, and it was, like, kind of like this panic created by the media.
Sure.
Somewhat similar to the satanic panic. Right. That happened back
Satanic
in the
panic.
That happened back in the 1980s with Satan worshippers.
Right.
Or I was also listening to Judas Priest and playing their Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah. Or I was also reading another article earlier saying that, like, no, there were more serial killers in the 70s and the 80s for some reason. But it's hard to track because the FBI doesn't actually track those numbers.
Yeah.
So all of that is to say, it's like, I can justify this in my head, like, in writing this episode. It's like, oh, yeah, serial killers happen all the time, and yeah, people just get,
bumped off in the park?
People just get bumped off in the park.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of the things that's also kind of interesting, and again, nature of the television show, producing things, trying to just get things done, and having, you can imagine that if you're a production designer on this particular program, there's so much work to do from episode to episode. You know, I mean, yeah, you're able to get away with cutting corners here or there, and you know, sure, there's probably a stock costume lot that you can go to and, you know, pull things from or whatever, but for the most part, to think that, okay, this week we're in 1960s New York, next week we're in 1959 Peoria, Illinois, you know, and having to change over all this stuff so quickly. But one of the things that is kind of missing, if we're going to go a little further and steer further into that sort of serial killer 80s movie trope, it doesn't feel nearly as, like, gritty. Like, this does not feel like a gritty, you know, late 70s, mid 80s New York.
This is very much a back lot.
Right.
You walk a few more blocks, you're going to walk around the corner in a 1959 Peoria, Illinois.
Exactly. And granted, I know that it's 1964 and not, you know, 1980 or whatever.
Sure.
But there is a certain sort of bit of grit, if you will, that's missing. And the next scene where he does, you know, the girl faints and he catches her because the Beatles are there, because she touches Ringo and she's so excited. That is so perfectly exactly what you just said about the back lot. That is, like, even sort of the crane shot that shows the car pull up and everything. If they went back just a little bit further, you were going to see, like, plywood and you know what I mean? Like, it's just like, it is so absolutely, you know, the back lot. But, I mean, that said, it still looks good, and it's not, I mean, I'm not knocking, you know, the production values at all. Just, we know intellectually in our heads, it's like, oh, okay, I know where you are. Mm-hmm. And that scene in particular, it's a little bit more overt than what we were getting earlier when they were talking about the Beatles. But it still doesn't feel quite as in your face as some of the other, like, kisses with history that we've had. Like,
sure.
Like Buddy Holly, you know?
Absolutely, yeah. This is still, he's not there to influence the Beatles or anything.
It's just
in the back.
Yeah, although it is funny because I think Matt writes in his book, I'm not spoiling anything, but later in the episode, Sam will be calling for Michelle as the Beatles are, like, coming out of the theater or whatever. And he kind of theorizes in his book, it's like, is this where the Beatles got the idea for the song Michelle?
Ah.
Which is just kind of funny. It's like, I mean, I don't think that's at all the intent or whatever, but it's
I don't think so, because Quantum Leap is not the most subtle show sometimes.
Right.
And if it was,
yes,
if they were trying to hint that, I think they would have.
Right.
They would have driven that home a little bit more.
Yeah, they would have steered harder into that.
Yeah. But anyway, so in this scene, Pete establishes that another girl was killed in
Sam Central Park last night. That his horse smells.
Yeah. Yes. And it's also interesting to note that Pete makes a reference, like, he just doesn't understand women.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because I can't remember exactly what he says.
He's like, he makes some comment like, I just don't understand women or something.
Yeah, why would they go walking through the park or something like that?
Yeah.
Oh, Pete. Mm-hmm. And he makes a joke about how Chopin saved him. He doesn't say anything about saving him from getting hit by the car. He says he saved him from getting a jaywalking
ticket.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Like, oh, Pete. And then we get Sam and Michelle in the diner, and it's a sweet little scene. And it's, again, there's a certain subtlety about the episode, at least compared to others, that I really appreciate in some of these moments, because there's no overt moment at least not yet, of Sam, like, telling Michelle, like, you know, you need to follow your dreams, or you need to be your own person, or you need to, like, there's no, it's interesting, because there's not that kind of, like, hell with your mother, you go out there and live your life, and do your own thing. It's just a little bit more subtle and more restrained, which I appreciate.
But to say, because watching this scene, we were talking about a couple weeks ago, when you were talking about, like, the Americanization of Machiko, like,
yes,
like, how that episode was kind of happening to Sam. Like, I feel like in this scene, it's like, he kind of, even though he knows he's there to save Michelle from being strangled that night,
right,
like, just from this conversation, like, he picks up, like, that Michelle's mom is kind of controlling,
yeah,
and without, like, being told, like, this is what he's there to do, and without, like, this dramatic voiceover of Sam realizing the thing that he's there to do, or, mm-hmm, or whatever, it's not heavy-handed, he's just like, oh, this sounds like maybe something I should...
Yeah,
maybe it's addressed.
Well, just, yeah, like, it's like we talked about before. You know, Sam's a good guy, and mm-hmm, when he kind of hears this and picks up on it, he, you know, there is that element of just sort of like, you know, like you're saying, like, I can help her.
Because this is the first time, because, like, we skipped over, but in the earlier scene of, mm-hmm, of her walking him home,
yeah,
there was another reference of, like, it's just not, basically, it's not the right time to meet my mom yet.
Yeah, right.
So in this scene, it coming up again, like, Sam starts to pick up, like, maybe there's a reason.
No. Yeah. Well, yeah, and that's the thing, is that she, you know, she says enough, or acts in enough of a way that Sam's just kind of like, she doesn't actually want to be a nurse.
Mm-hmm.
There's also that great moment with the mustard.
Yeah, there are a couple, yeah, with the mustard, and then he compliments Michelle on her smile.
Yeah.
He's not very good at being blind.
No, he is not. You know, he's able to, for the most part, cover it very, very well. The smile one is a little cheesy. I mean, it's fine. I'm not criticizing it. But it's just, it's funny, because he's like, I can tell by your laugh that you have a good smile. It's like, that doesn't make any sense.
The
mustard thing, like, I couldn't smell the mustard. It's like, okay, yeah, sure, I get that. Michelle even says something about, like, oh, wow, wouldn't it be wonderful to have such a strong sense of smell? Mm-hmm. And the waitress has a line about, like, not with my husband's feet.
Yeah.
But Michelle has to take off. When she leaves, we find out that Agnes has been following her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, Agnes.
Yeah.
Oh,
and then we Agnes. And then we get back to Andrew/Sam's home.
Mm-hmm.
And Al is there and greets him. We get this moment of Al antagonizing Chopin, saying, yeah, your mother's afraid of cats, and Chopin
jumps
attacking
him.
Like, how many seeing eye dogs just randomly attack?
Right.
And not just, like, bark, but, like, actually, like, make a running,
like,
leap.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get it. I get...
He made a leap, and it was noteworthy.
I'm just gonna show myself that. Sam will host the rest of this episode. We get the nice hologram effect.
Yeah.
Which I think, realistically, it's like that moment halfway through the episode. Hey, in case you're just tuning in and you've never seen this episode of television before, this guy is not really there. Here's an effect to show you that.
And it's done in a fun way, though, too. Mm-hmm. Like, I love Al's just, like, antagonizing the dog. Mm-hmm. It's not one of those. It didn't feel terribly out of place. And it
for sure, yeah.
Yeah, but you're right. It is sort of just like, this guy, you know.
Yes. But it also establishes that Chopin can be aggressive when need be.
That's also, yes.
And that will come back into play.
It's an economy of storytelling.
Yes, that will come back into play later on. Later on in the story.
And so Chopin is hungry, and Sam has to feed the dog.
Mm-hmm.
And when he...
Barco Bites.
Yeah.
Which I meant to look up, and I never did look up if Barco Bites was actually an existing brand. Of dog food back in the day?
I mean, it would kind of go along, I suppose, with all of the other little references that get dropped here and there about a certain thing. A certain item, if you will, like Burma Shave or something else. Yeah, I can't find it. I can't find anything.
I found a great Barco dog food, but anyway. So the important part is that Sam is reading... I think apparently with his apartment door wide open.
Yeah.
Apparently.
Why was his door open?
Because that's what made the plot of the episode work.
Right.
So he's just reading with the door open, and so he's reading the box of dog food to Chopin, and Agnes walks in and catches the blind man reading.
Yep.
And then she says, well, that's a neat trick, a blind man reading a dog food
box. And you know, he's like, why didn't you say something to Al? And Al's like, I did.
And, yeah. And, of and she's course, like, yeah.
I did.
Yeah. Yeah, that's double, another one of those great double-sided conversations. Yeah. And so from this, we get, like, she's like, I don't know what your scheme is. I don't care. Stay away from my daughter.
Or I will tell the world.
Or I will ruin you. And they don't, like, they don't beat you over the head with this, but in this version of reality, Andrew Ross is supposedly, he's someone who is actually very famous.
Yeah.
And is well known.
He's the Ray Charles of classical music.
So, yeah. So, yeah, this could ruin him.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
To be outed in such a way.
And, you know, it's one of the things that is interesting about it is I feel like Sam, they don't belabor it, but it does, Sam realizes what this could do. You know, we've talked before about how sometimes Sam will do something when he's in someone else's life, and it almost seems like without any regard to what's going to happen once he leaps out. Mm-hmm. Whereas this, he feel the weight of it lands a little bit more on him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, I think part of it sure is just like, oh, I want to keep Andrew and Michelle together. Sure. Fine. But I think that beyond that, there's this element of like, oh man, I could have just ruined this guy's life by getting careless.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, which is nice.
I think if they were less subtle, and I think, with the way the writing of the show evolved throughout the series, I think if this had come later in the series, like, we would have had Al in the background, like, consulting the handmaid, going, no, if this happens,
there's an 82% chance
82% that Andrew's gonna,
yeah.
And then so from there, I think we're getting like right into the concert.
We are, yeah, because
this episode just moves.
It really does. It's obviously we'll give our summations later, but it's a good episode. It really is.
It is. I feel like this is the first just straightforward regular episode. We learn a little bit about Sam here in a little bit about his background.
Right.
But other than that, like, there's no, like, mythology. There's no deep background in the characters. It's not a special episode.
Right.
There's not a gimmick. This is just a very simple, this is a very simple hour of television.
Well, and one of the things that's interesting too, and I can't remember, honestly, I can't remember if it's in Matt Dale's book or if it was something that I read online, but one of the comments that I did read is that there was an appreciation for the fact that it doesn't try to be like a message episode about the blind guy, you know, and in a way that makes even more of a statement that this guy lives a normal life, you know, that it's not that his impaired vision is not some sort of hurdle to overcome.
Mm-hmm.
It just so happens that, you know,
that's
who he is.
That's his thing.
And so that's kind of nice and makes a statement in and of itself that they're not trying to make a statement with it.
Absolutely.
But yeah, he's getting ready for the concert. He apologizes to the mirror image.
So now here is my beef with this episode. It is a very simple hour of television.
Yes.
But
not a special hour.
It's not a special. Yeah, yeah.
It's a simple
hour. Yeah, it's a simple hour of television. But the thing is, Sam has to play this concert, and he may very well, you know, ruin Andrew's career. But why? It's established that Andrew Ross has a very well-established reputation.
Mm-hmm.
There's no information from Al or Ziggy saying that if he doesn't play this particular concert, something drastic is going to happen to him.
Right.
Or if he falls on... It falls on his face, metaphorically.
Right.
If that something is going to happen to him. So, like, watching this episode this time, I was sort of like, why does Sam have to play this concert? And so I played this little game, and I don't want to turn this into a regular segment, because I'm not a fan of, like, regular, you know, segments as part of a podcast or whatever. But, like, if I were Sam in this episode, how I would go about saving Michelle without the podcast, I would just get sick.
Mm-hmm.
And I would cancel the concert, and I would ask her to come over and
make me soup
and take care of me.
Yeah.
And just keep her there throughout the night so that she doesn't get strangled in Central Park.
Dirty dog.
That means, like, the serial killer is still out there.
Right.
But, you know, Sam wasn't doing much detective work throughout the day to try to find the serial killer in advance anyway. So I guess his plan was just, like, to get through the concert and then just hang on to Michelle so she doesn't get away. So just don't play the concert and have her stay with you. problem solved.
That, yeah. Well, and I think that, I think sort of piggyback on that, that one of the, you know, if I am to point out a flaw, and they, I mean, it's a good, like I said, it's a good episode, but it does have a few flaws, that probably the biggest flaw, and you mentioned this earlier, is the fact that there have been four, at this point, murders that we're aware of.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right, there doesn't seem to be, like, Sam is not, I have to find out who the killer is, or I have to do something to, you know, to act on this. It's, he, his focus is purely on playing the concert and saving Michelle.
Mm.
And that's fine, because that's his mission. But it does seem interesting that we don't get, like, a scene of Sam poring over the newspapers, for instance. Like, you know what I mean? Like, again, if we're going to do this what if instead of catching him reading the box of dog food, Agnes had caught him reading the newspapers trying to figure out clues about the serial killer? I feel like something like that would have kind of just brought us a little bit closer to, you know, to sort of that, this is what Sam would do if he were in this situation.
Yeah. And then you can get this whole thing of Agnes going like, why are you reading about the serial killer? Are you the serial killer? Then we go down this, go down this whole other.
Absolutely. And now she's got to protect her daughter from the serial killer.
Yeah.
The blind man who's not really blind, who's out there strangling girls in the park. Totally different story.
That would have let's do a fanfic.
Yeah, this right episode. There we go.
But again, to me, like the way I reason through that, like from a writing perspective, is like this episode takes place in the 1960s, but when it was written in the 1980s, I feel like there was just kind of this like this thing in pop culture, like yeah, people get killed by serial killers all the time, and it just happens. It's kind of like that thing that you hear all the time. Like when I was a kid, I thought quicksand was going to be much more of a problem than what it actually is.
Yes.
It's just like, you know, like in the 1980s, we just thought, yeah, getting killed by a serial killer, that,
right,
that happens.
And there's also, and look, there's probably also an element of like, what is Sam going to do? You know, what could he do?
For sure. I mean, and to expand further beyond that, like, just like beyond the serial killer thing, like when Sam leaps into a small southern town, which he does a lot of throughout the series, that's one thing. But you're leaping to New York City.
Yeah.
If he wanted to get like really overzealous and save the world, like he could get out, like, tell me every bad thing that's going to happen within a 2-mile radius.
Right.
Over the next 12 hours.
Okay, this is such a weird tangent, but that just made me think of the Spider-Man 2 video game for, like, the Xbox and PlayStation years ago. So, there were a couple of Spider-Man video games that came out, but Spider-Man 2, which was sort of based on the film, was probably one of the finest. And one of the things that made the game so great is it was open world New York. You could literally like web swing from one end of New York to the other. And as you would go along, like there would be random crimes that would happen, like a purse snatcher here or a bank robbery here. And you could choose to stop these and you'd like earn points or whatever. Mm. And so it just in my brain, all of a sudden, all I could think of is like Sam going through New York, like in this game, like just stopping every little crime.
Yeah.
Like handing an old lady back her purse.
If you wanted to get over that, yeah. Right. I wasn't thinking. I was like, you know, I was thinking more like Superman, but yeah.
Well, sure,
Superman. Yeah. You know,
oh, if only we could get a good Superman video game.
Can't I?
Anyway,
anyway, but Sam has to play the concert,
right? And he so Michelle comes in, helps him with his tie, which is a cute little moment. And this is when Sam does kind of start to empower Michelle. But again, it doesn't feel it's a wonderful scene because it feels about her, not about Sam trying to save her, which I really enjoy because we learn a little bit more about the nature of the relationship with her mother. And even though I don't think it would be a leap for anyone to surmise this anyway, but she talks about how, you know, her mother tells her she's not pretty enough or talented enough or, you know, these sorts of things. And, you know, and Sam's trying to reassure her that she can do this and that, you know, yes, while she owes her mother her love, she doesn't owe her life. And it's a nice little moment there before Sam has to go and now play.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. And I don't know if we meet him now or if we meet him in the middle of the concert, but this is...
yeah!
Noteworthy. I'm going to keep coming back to it.
Bum, bum.
This is in Matt Dale's book.
I know what you're going to say.
Yeah, Sloane Fisher.
Yeah.
The stagehand was the reflection in How the Test Was Won.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is I think there's like, I don't know if they ever show a shot of Scott Bakula standing next to Sloane Fisher, But even just standing next to Agnes and Michelle, it's very clear that he is a shorter.
Yep.
He is a shorter man. Obviously, probably a lot shorter than Scott Bakula. And it's
like
interesting.
He had a good like head. Like,
yeah. But in How the Test Was Won, they have him up on the.
Yeah.
On the same level.
It's interesting here too because I feel like in How the Test Was Won, he had a little bit more hair.
Or they don't show it because he's wearing the hat.
That's
and he
true.
Doesn't.
Yeah.
But
anyway.
But yeah. But anyway. So.
Oh, but there is this great moment. And the reason why we meet him, which is lovely, is that Agnes is smoking backstage, and he like comes and he's like, "You have to put out your cigarette." And she's like all shitty with him, and it's like, "Yeah, I'm not going to put out my cigarette. I don't have to do what you tell me to do or whatever."
I think the really shitty thing is she doesn't even. Say anything, she just ignores him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then when she does finally decide to put it out, because Michelle kind of, she like just throws it on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
And it's.
I can't put my finger on it. I can't explain why it is. But again, to me, that just seems like a very 80s thing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, and it's interesting because this is also something from Matt Dale's book. But apparently the actress, Janice Rhodes, who plays Agnes, Jennifer Rhodes, excuse me, she used to smoke, like, prior to this episode, but she had quit smoking, and so she felt as though she was a bad television smoker. Like, she felt it didn't look right, that she wasn't inhaling, because she'd quit smoking, and all this sort of stuff, and I thought that was funny, because I quit smoking, years and years and years ago now. It's probably been about, like, 10 years or so, not that I ever did it regularly or very long, but I have had to smoke like on stage or in a film that I was in a couple of years ago, and I just did it, you know what I mean? I was like, I'm, you know, whatever, fine. This isn't going to make me go out and buy a pack tomorrow.
That's interesting. Coming up on 10 years ago, 9 years ago, yeah. I was I'm a very adamant non-smoker because. Smoking did not kill my parents, but they were in the getaway car. Smoking was in the getaway car, if that metaphor works.
Yeah.
But a few months after my mom passed away, I was in a show. It was like a short play festival. I was in like a 10-minute piece.
Yeah.
Where I decided this character smokes. And even though by that point you weren't supposed to smoke in Chicago theaters, the director and the producer, he didn't care. Like, we were, like, in a small studio space, like, in Ravenswood. So I was like, yeah, if you want to smoke. So for, like, 2 months, I smoked.
Yeah.
Like, I bought cigarettes. I walked down the street smoking. I went out for smoke breaks. And I'm sure it was a weird coping mechanism in the wake of my mom passing away. But yeah, I just became a smoker for a couple months, and then once the show was over with, I stopped.
Well, sorry, no, go
ahead. No, because it gave me insight more into smokers, like, oh, that's smoke breaks, or just like you get more built-in breaks in the day. And well, I totally got it, but then yeah, I totally dropped it once that show was done.
Yeah. And it's definitely something, I mean, the social aspect of it, especially like as an actor, and I feel as though nowadays the vast majority of actors I know don't smoke, but I would say that 10 years ago, that was not the case at all, because one of the first like jobs I had at school, I didn't smoke at the time, but almost the entire rest of the cast did. And so whenever we were on a break in rehearsal or an intermission or whatever, they all would go outside and I would be left like alone in the dressing room. And so I was like, well, I'm going to start going outside with them. And I would go outside and I wouldn't smoke. And then one day I was just sort of like, hey, it's not like I've never smoked a cigarette before, and I'll bum one from somebody or whatever, you know. And then 3 years later, it was like, I'm not going to do this anymore. Mm-hmm. But the last two times that I have done it, I've actually, in the film that I was in, they were herbal cigarettes, which was weird. They don't taste good, I'll tell you that much. Mm-hmm. And then the time before that, when I was on stage, they were actually cloves.
Okay.
Because the director had this this thought that he wanted the cigarettes to be black instead of, you know, your regular white cigarettes. And so he decided to get cloves. So the cigarettes were all these like blacks, kind of stylized, you know, production or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't supposed to be that I was smoking a clove cigarette. It was supposed to be that I was smoking a cigarette. It was just that the cigarettes were black.
Mm-hmm.
And it made a lot more sense when he explained it. But anyway, yeah, it's just interesting to me that Agnes is here smoking in pretty much every scene she's in, and that Jennifer Rhodes had quit smoking and felt that she did a poor job of smoking on screen.
One, I didn't notice it until, I read the same thing in Matt's book. And two, it's... yes, the smoking comes in later towards the end of the episode. Because I was trying, like, why do we even need that as a plot element? But it comes later on, yeah. So, but before we even get to this scene, Sam starts the concert. Yeah, yep, he goes out.
Because
he's about to start playing Chopsticks.
Yeah.
By the way, I love the line earlier that we skimmed over. Because earlier in the episode, like, Al assures Sam's like, don't worry, tomorrow night, you're going to give a great concert.
Yeah.
And Sam's like, you're a concert pianist. And I love his line, I couldn't play Chopsticks in Chinatown.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Just the alliteration.
I
just love that line. So Sam goes out to start the concert, and he's putting his fingers together, like, he's about... You're going to go back to that well...
Yeah.
...once again.
I don't think this audience is going to...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then Al shows up, says, you can do better than Chopsticks, and he pulls out.
He's got a music stand with
him. For your eyes only. Yeah, yeah, we get this nice little bit where he takes the hand away, and
it disappears.
I think this is the first time in the series that we establish... this is kind of in contradiction, because in Starcrossed, Al gets dragged out of the imaging chamber.
Right, and we don't see them.
Wait a minute. I can go back and I can justify that. Because when he's getting dragged out of the imaging chamber, nobody dragging him out is actually touching Al's skin.
Okay, that's what I thought that's what you would say, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true,
but
though.
But in this case, like, he's touching the music stand with his hand, and that's why
with his fingers,
Yeah.
Well, and we will see later, without going into too much detail, that he is, like, he has to hold someone's hand, like, skin, in order for them to show up.
For them to be seen,
So, yeah. But yeah, it's a nice little moment, and Sam's like, I can't play this, and I was like, of course you can. And I just love, there's something about Stockwell in this episode, where, like, all of these sort of moments that Sam's freaking out about, he's so nonchalant about it. He's like, of course you could do this. What are you talking about?
For sure. And also, and we'll come to a moment later on. I also think that comes from just a necessity from the writing. It's like, we don't have a lot of time for Al to learn how to play a concert and do all this other stuff. And so we just see this reassurance, like, no, you're going to be fine.
Yeah.
Here you go. Just start.
Yeah. And he does, and that's when Al, drops the line about how Sam played Carnegie Hall when he was 19 years old.
That's, yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
That's a really interesting info drop.
It is.
Compared, like, what would come later on this, yeah.
Yeah.
The mini lives of Sam Beckett.
Right, right. And it's definitely not something that I have a problem with. But certainly, by the beginning of the third season in particular, it does make me wonder about a couple of things. And it's just kind of like, okay, sure, maybe he did this, but he was just an Indiana farm boy. And
how do you squeeze all of this, this in?
All his doctorates. And yes, of course, he's supposed to be this genius, but, anyway.
Anyway.
It's whatever. He's the hero of our TV show.
Yeah, he's the hero.
He can do anything. The man can do anything.
I have a theory. It goes on a huge tangent. We'll squeeze it in some other time.
All right. I'll look forward to it.
Maybe off mic. But anyway, so while he's out playing the concert, this conversation that we just talked about is going on between the stagehand, Michelle, and Agnes, and this is when Agnes drops, he's not blind, I saw him reading. I don't know if she goes into detail, but he's not blind. Like, your boyfriend is a scam.
And one quick thought too here that I think is very funny is that all of the older adults in New York City are in Carnegie Hall, but all the teenage girls are down the street at the Beatles Hotel.
Yes.
There's no young people in the audience for Sam's concert.
They're all.
But he finishes, it's a smash, everything's great. He goes off stage. As he gets off stage, he immediately says, something about Agnes being there. And Michelle is like, it is true.
You can see.
And she runs off in tears.
Yeah.
And of course, at that moment, it's like, oh, great.
Yeah.
She just ran off and she's going to die.
And as she runs off and as Sam chases after her, Agnes lights another cigarette.
Yes, she does. In the wings.
My work here is done.
Oh, mama.
Meanwhile, Al is bowing and
Yes, and waving at the pretty woman in the audience. Mm-hmm. There's a blonde in the audience that he keeps waving and blowing kisses to.
Absolutely.
Speaking of the Beatles and all the young teenage girls, mm-hmm. Sam is kind of caught in a bit of a fracas with all of the throng of people trying to see the Beatles, and he drops his glasses, mm-hmm. bends down to pick them up, and when he turns around,
yeah.
a flashbulb goes off right in his eyes.
He gets totally Raymond Burr in Rear Window.
That's right. Yes. Nice.
Look that reference up, kids.
Yes, do. Yeah. It's a phenomenal film.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah, and so now he can't see for real. Mm-hmm. And he has to go and save Michelle. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Michelle is running through the park, and there's serial killer music playing, mm-hmm. even down to aping, like, the Friday the 13th, like,
Oh, it does. Yeah, yeah.
And this is another one of those moments that I mentioned at the top of the show about just, like, cheese-tastic stuff that we didn't need, but we got because it was a television show that was produced in 1989. There's a full-on lengthy shot of a man in a black ski mask dressed in black just standing at the top of the stairs.
That was, the 1980s serial killer motif, and not just the shot, but then of him, like, pulling out the black rope or string or whatever and making his intentions known.
And then running after her, and of course catching her and tussling mm-hmm. to the ground, and then he starts to strangle her. And I have to say, one thing that I really appreciate, though, is I appreciated Michelle's, like,
ingenuity.
Well, yeah, but she's not just some sort of, like, oh, I'm a small girl who's been tackled by this man, and I'm just going to give up and die now. Mm-hmm. You know, not that anyone would do that in real life, but I feel like there's so many of these types of films out there, or television mm-hmm. programs out there, where that's what happens. Mm-hmm. And instead she fights back, you know, she gets her
nail file.
Yeah, and stabs him in the back.
Stabs him in the back.
And then runs off.
A tangent as far as strangling goes. It takes about 7 minutes to actually strangle someone to death. How do I know this? This was a show that you saw that I was in a couple years ago.
Oh, yeah.
Not to offend anyone, but the title of the show was called Angry Fags. I won't go into what the show is about. It's a very noteworthy show written by Topher Payne. It was part of the Stephen Wolf Garage series a couple years ago here in Chicago.
Yeah.
My college buddy, Jacob York, he was in the world premiere of it in Atlanta.
Oh, nice.
When it debuted a couple years before that. But anyway, there is a scene where it's a very difficult scene to watch, but one of the characters is strangled to death.
Yeah.
And so that became a discussion, like, one day during rehearsal, like, how long does it actually take to, like, actually not just, like, no, she's not strangled, she's smothered to death. But it's still, I think it's like the same principle of like cutting off the air.
Right.
And it takes significantly longer than what they show
in
entertainment.
Yeah.
And we're sitting around rehearsal, and I pulled out my phone, I googled, how long does it take to smother someone? Yeah, I'm on a watch list now somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. You pinged some database, and they're like, oh, well.
Then I'm one of them. And it became noteworthy.
Oh boy!
To go back, because somebody who came to see the show, they actually thought that that character had not died, because it took them so little time to smother them to death on stage.
Yeah,
they thought that they had just knocked her out, and then a twist at the end of the play. Because there's a lot of twist that comes at the end of this play.
Yeah, yeah.
They thought a twist at the end of the play was going to be that she hadn't actually died.
She's still alive. Yeah, interesting. Yeah. No, I mean, I thought she was dead. You know.
Yeah. So Michelle stabs the guy in the back with the nail file, gets away, and so we get some shots of Sam making his way with Chopin, with Al.
Yes. And then it's at this point we get what I would argue is the worst moment of the episode. And just when I saw
it, I'm going to argue it's the best moment of the episode.
And then
I'll tell you why. All right. So go ahead.
So Michelle runs up and finds Pete. And is so relieved that Pete is there, the cop, to save her. Mm-hmm. Throws her arms around him, and then there's something wrong. She pulls her hand away. It's covered in blood. She realizes Pete is the strangler.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Why?
Mm-hmm. So first off, I'm going to jump back and say a few minutes before this, when Betsy and I were watching the episode together.
Yeah.
I turned to her and was like, "So who do you think the killer is?" And she thought about it, and she was like, "Literally, the only other character in this episode is the cop."
Yeah.
So it's like, if you're paying halfway attention, like, unless they just introduce a character out of nowhere,
which is what I think I would have preferred, honestly.
Yeah. But yeah, if it's going to be a character that you've already met, the only other character you have besides Agnes,
right?
or the stagehand.
Yeah, the stagehand. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Or a great twist could have been is that she goes into the park and nothing happens.
That's, yeah.
Nothing happens at all. And then you find out that Andrew Ross is a serial
killer. Oh, no.
How's he doing it blind? Chopin.
That's right, Chopin. He's using his dog to creep up behind people. And, oh, my God.
But anyway, this episode, this scene, the very, like, of her, like, hugging him and pulling her hand back to the blood. In college, me and my friends did a short 20-minute horror movie.
Okay.
Some of us, not all of us, some of us were doing, like, an independent study that got approved, like, about horror movies. So part of the project was, like, shooting a horror movie. I'm not even sure if the people who edited it had, actual, like, video editing equipment or was all done in VCRs.
Sure.
I'm not sure. It was that bad.
Yeah, yeah.
But, I jumped in later on in the process, and I helped write some of it, and I totally aped this scene, this gimmick, and we used it in the movie.
Sure.
We were up in the theater, on the catwalk, and, someone's fiddling with the spotlight, she gets chased, she is able to stab the killer in the back, and then she runs away, she runs into... me, my character, she hugs me, pulls a hand away, blood, and then I kill her.
You.
Totally ate the scene. Anyway, but yeah, that is a very 80s-tastic scene.
Yeah, and I was just sort of like, okay, fine, I'll go with it, whatever.
Yeah.
And I will say that if you look back at the episode, from the very beginning, there is that huge clue, basically, of... you know, Fifi leaves with her two dogs to go... that's just the name I have for her. Mm-hmm. Leaves with her two dogs to go walk them in the park. Immediately after that,
Pete
is leaving and goes out too. You know, so it's like, right there, it's like, okay, mm-hmm. I get it. But then, during the tussle, Sam does show up, and Chopin really saves the day. Like, mm-hmm. you know, gets on Pete and starts biting into him. Pete has dropped his handcuffs... because I guess he still has those with him.
Sure.
And Al is encouraging him to go get the handcuffs so he can cuff Pete.
I haven't watched this episode in a while. It is such a weird, awkward scene. Like, I get that Chopin has Pete down.
Yes, right.
It still seems a little bit of a stretch that he's able to subdue him enough to not get away so that fumbling, blind Sam can actually get the handcuffs in.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And we never actually see him cuff Pete, right? Like, he gets the cuffs, he goes over to Pete, and then we cut almost immediately away to, like, the cops pulling
Pete away. I think they show him, but there's no, like, close-up. Yeah. It's just, like, from a long, like, master shot, like, you see him putting the handcuffs off. And then, we cut away to him getting handcuffed, and Pete makes him line, like, I gotta take care of the girls.
Yeah. And Agnes shows up and is berating Sam for putting Michelle in harm's way because it's all his fault. In the meantime, which is, again, kind of cool, and that sort of, like, economy of storytelling, we don't get the actual scene of it happen, but Michelle relates to Agnes that Sam explained away being able to tell that it was Agnes by smelling her perfume.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the moment you were talking about where Agnes goes to light...
to prove it. Yeah. She throws the match in Sam's face. And
but because Sam's still kind of blinded by the flashbulbs, he can't see it, so he doesn't react. And Agnes immediately is like...
I gotta say this.
Yeah.
If I'm weighing throwing a match in someone's face suddenly and them not reacting versus literally watching them read a dog food box, I'm gonna give weight to literally reading a dog food box. But anyway, let's call it economy of storytelling.
Yes. You see what you wanna see.
Mm-hmm.
Or not.
But yeah.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm. And then we get this, we're wrapping up, where basically...
Yes.
Sam and Michelle encourage Agnes to let Michelle live her own life.
Which is really nice, because one of the things that I really enjoyed is that there's the twist here is that it becomes just as much about kind of saving Agnes as it does about having mm-hmm. saved Michelle. And it's really nice. And again, this is what I was talking about earlier with Jennifer Rhodes and the work that she does here. I feel like that moment of her being like, you know, my life's not over. I can live a life. I can go do these things. It just plays really well. And I liked it. And it didn't feel so, like, yeah, 5 minutes ago I was like, oh, God, she's a terrible human being. But not to the point where... Not to the point where I'm writing off this change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was sort of like, okay, good for you, Agnes. Yeah, go live your life. Mm-hmm. Now let Michelle live hers too. So it was just kind of a nice moment, and I liked it. And unfortunately, there's two things that I want to mention. One is before Sam gets to the park, actually. So this is going back a little bit. After he's been blinded by the flashbulb, he says, I can't see, I can't see, I can't see. 3 times. And then, because it's 1980s television and we have to have a button line for the fucking commercial, he says, I may as well be blind.
Turning and looking, not quite cross-eyed, but
yeah.
Kind of, yeah.
And it's like,
I was going to let that moment pass when we glossed over that earlier. Yeah.
And then we get Al saying to Sam, well, you really opened her eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Ah. Now, luckily, Dean Stockwell's delivery is nice, because he says something to the effect of, like, that was really nice, Sam, really well done. Like, he's congratulating Sam
yeah.
on not only doing it, but how he did it.
Mm-hmm.
And then he throws in the, you really opened her eyes. It's like, yeah. Okay.
And before we get to the line of you really opened her eyes, to get back to the economy of storytelling, Sam's sight starts coming back.
Oh, yes.
And I think it's one of those things, like, we don't have time to go to the hospital. We don't have time for Sam to get treated or whatever and, you know, go through that awkward thing. So Dean Stockwell has the delivered line, you know, like, wonderful things, the eyes, the tears, the cleansing agent.
Yeah.
And it was like this beautiful, just like, how are we going to wrap this up in 2 minutes?
Yeah, right, yeah. Right. And, you know, it is interesting because, and I don't know how I feel about it. I really can't decide right now, but Sam clearly was going to be very, very upset if his sight did not return.
Mm-hmm.
To the point that he is literally on the verge of tears of joy over his sight returning.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I really, unfortunately, don't have anything more to say than that, but
mm-hmm.
it's an interesting moment and choice. It feels a little melodramatic.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's wrong. I don't know if it's the wrong choice or the bad choice. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess, Scott Bakula had to imbue it with some stakes.
Right.
Some
right.
some fear that you know, his eyesight was going to come back.
Yeah.
But even though, like, this is 80s television, we're going to wrap the story up here. He's going to have his eyesight back by the time we get to
the good old Star Trek reset button.
Yeah. Boom.
Yeah.
Back to the end of the episode.
Speaking of which... That is where we are.
Yeah, so he leaps. We get this cute moment of, like, Chopin, like, actually sees the leap effect
yeah.
and starts, yeah. It's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is.
And now he's a DJ. I'm trying to, because I know when we get into the episode proper next week, it's actually Tutti Frutti playing. Is it Tutti Frutti playing at the end of the episode? I can't remember. Because
no.
sometimes, like, the music does
yeah.
a weird thing.
I cannot... Yes, it is Tutti Frutti. It is
okay.
Tutti Frutti playing, because one of the things that's interesting about that is in the DVD version, they replaced the leap out in this episode with some random weird disco music, but in Good Morning Peoria, the episode, it was still Tutti Frutti.
Frutti, got it.
But yeah,
okay.
so they restored that in the Blu-rays.
Okay.
Speaking of which, actually, let's go ahead and just get to this
yes.
real quick. We had some feedback recently. When frequently, I think more than twice anyway, we have lamented, understanding though that financial reasons prohibited them from doing this, that there were no special features on the Blu-rays, no behind the scenes documentaries, audio commentaries, etc., deleted scenes, whatever, and how obviously we would have loved that there would be those. An even more important missing feature on these Blu-rays, and arguably one that is really incomprehensible in this day and age is the lack of any sort of subtitles or closed captioning. And this was something that was pointed out to us by...
One of our listeners, Dana. I apologize if we mispronounce your last name. Bias? Bias? B-I-U-S?
Yes. Bias. We'll go with that.
Sure.
I'm sorry, Dana. We're terrible hosts. We should have asked you beforehand.
Anyway, but she wrote us and said, you know, thanks for like calling out Mill Creek, which is the company that put out the Blu-rays, for the lack of extras. But she noted in particular the lack of subtitles and captioning because, as a hearing impaired fan such as she is, the Blu-rays are essentially useless to her because she can't enjoy the show.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, she even went on further to say something about how it's something oftentimes that other people don't consider. You know, if it doesn't affect them, they're not thinking about it. Mm-hmm. And obviously that's very true because it's something that we weren't thinking about. But we will say it's something we were both aware of. We did actually know that that was the case. Mm-hmm. And I do think that, yeah, it is a little mystifying. And again, I would even go so far as to say inexcusable that that's not a feature that's included. And I know that there are other DVDs and Blu-rays out there that share that. Mm-hmm. And it's too bad. And it's definitely something that you want to say, yeah, do better.
We put this episode out, we're going to tag Mill Creek. I'm sure they must have a Twitter account or something.
Absolutely.
We'll tag them. And
I don't know if they have enough money for that.
but something, yeah.
And I will say, you know, we are, without a doubt, we are grateful to have these Blu-rays as fans of the television show, in particular because the music has been restored, and clearly that was something that was going to cost money and be difficult to navigate those waters. And one can only imagine how, I mean, there are certain television programs that we may just never get because of music rights, and because, you know, up until about 15 years ago or so, it just wasn't even a consideration. When you purchased rights for music for a television program, you never even thought about the fact that it would be on DVD or Blu-ray or streaming or whatever. And there are some shows that are out there that will forever be incomplete. Roswell is a good example of that. You know, Roswell, the music has been almost wholly replaced. Now, the thing about that show, however, that's really cool is that the original music supervisors went and picked new music that they felt fit the scene by new bands. And the interesting thing about it is that the entire time they were actually working on the show, that's what they did. They went out and they found new bands and they picked music that they were like, hey, this is a great way to use new music that people don't know that fits our show. And so while there are some exceptions of big songs missing from the show, there's other times when it's just sort of like, oh, okay, that's cool. Like, they used Coldplay before Coldplay was huge in the United States, you know what I mean? And they had to take some of that music out, but they went and they found another, like, young up-and-coming British band, and they were like, we'll use their music, and it fits. And so sometimes it works. Sometimes it's an opportunity to kind of just, you know, get out there and do some more art. Mm-hmm. But in other instances with a show like Ed, for instance, which I love that show, mm-hmm. we'll probably never see a DVD release of it because music rights, you know? So all that said, I mean, we're very grateful that we have this, and Mill Creek, you know, clearly put some effort into it. If they would have had a little bit more faith, I think, in the way that these box sets have sold.
A little bit more blind faith.
Oh, God. I think it's noteworthy.
Yes.
If they had a little bit more faith in the sales, perhaps they could have done a little bit more. But regardless, they should have included subtitles or closed captioning.
Absolutely.
And again, one of the things I will note is that these Blu-rays have sold very well, to the point that they have been sold out on Amazon at least twice that I'm aware of.
Oh, that's cool.
In fact, when they first came out, it was sold out on Amazon within, like, the first week of their release.
Oh.
And it sold out again. And it must be selling well enough to justify the fact that a lot of other, you know, DVDs that come out, they usually slash prices on pretty quickly afterwards if they're not selling well. Like, sometimes up to 50% off.
Mm-hmm.
The Blu-rays are, like, $70 right now. And they've been lower than that before, but it's like there must be a demand for them if they're selling for like $60-$70 and getting away with it and selling out on occasion.
I'm taking a look here right now. Yeah, the entire series now on Amazon is $65.
Yeah.
If you want to get the entire series on DVD, it's $40 now. But
Blu-rays are nice, you know, and I will continue to say that one of the things that I noticed about this episode is the second season just continues to look really good on Blu-ray, which is nice.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Blind Faith, it's a good episode, it really is. I enjoyed watching it, it clips by at a good pace, there's some good, you know, humorous moments in the show. There's one that I feel is not intentionally humorous when we get the killer, not the reveal, that's Pete, but the reveal of the masked serial killer in the park.
Yes.
It's like,
yeah.
Okay.
But you're misplaced. You're not in the 1960s. That's a 1980s
right
thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, like I said before.
So just put him in a hockey mask.
Yes, or, yeah. It's probably the first, very straightforward episode.
Yeah.
No gimmick, no special thing going on, just...
Right.
Yeah. If Angela Lansbury isn't around to solve a murder, let's get Sam Beckett.
I would have watched the Murder She Wrote Quantum Leap crossover.
Mm-hmm. I had a friend, I didn't know her very well, but I met her through the improv scene when I first moved to Chicago.
Uh-huh.
And we bonded early on over her deep love of Quantum Leap.
Nice.
But when she was a kid, her parents allowed her to watch only an hour of television a week.
Oh, wow.
So she alternated between Quantum Leap and Murder, She Wrote.
Wow.
And then hopefully eventually she got to go back and watch.
God, I hope she didn't alternate all the time. Murder, She Wrote had some two-parters. Quantum Leap had some two-parters.
Two-parters, yeah.
You miss out.
Murder, She Wrote lasted for 11
seasons. Oh, man. Yeah, it was on a long time.
It was on, yeah.
Hell, it was on all the way up, because I remember that there was, they put it up against Friends at one point, because CBS was kind of trying to kill the show off, but it was still popular enough, and then when they put it up against Friends, that's when it started to die. And in the final season, there's actually an episode where she goes to, like, she's on the set of a TV show that's being filmed that is a thinly veiled version
Friends?
Of Friends, and it's like basically like one of the castmates kills one of the other castmates, and Ross kills Rachel, and
because to me, like, Murder, She Wrote is such a firmly 80s show. It's hard to wrap my head around of Murder, She Wrote and Friends existing at the same time on television.
I know, but yeah, they did. And then she even did some TV movies, you know, up into, mm-hmm. I mean, not that long ago, I think. Well, at this point, it's probably 10 years plus. But
mm-hmm.
1984 to 1996.
Wow.
264 episodes in 12 seasons with 4 TV movies.
Oh, it will run in syndication.
Oh, forever.
Yeah.
Forever.
But anyway... So yeah, that's my parting thoughts on Blind Faith. Yeah,
just
nice, straightforward episode.
Absolutely,
it was nice to remember. Yeah, to like the serial killer motif that we had. This is not the last time Quantum Leap will visit the serial killer motif.
And I feel like I'm just going to say this now, even though it might be more appropriate to say it 5 episodes from now or whatever. I feel like we are beginning to get into a real sweet spot with season 2.
Mm-hmm.
There are a number of episodes coming up, which may have a couple of flaws or issues here or there, that I feel like overall we're about to hit a stretch of about 6 episodes that are just damn good.
Oh yeah, I was looking on the Blu-rays this morning and yeah.
Very
interested to get into this stretch.
And I would say that really, you know, we got Honeymoon Express and Disco Inferno, which are 2 strong episodes. I was not a huge fan of the 2 after that, but now we're into, we're getting into kind of the sweet spot of the show, and it's nice, you know, and the episodes do fly by, so
mm-hmm.
we're going to fly out of here
fly
now.
Here. That being said, we're recording these episodes early, but if I do remember correctly from what we discussed logistic-wise, this is going to be our last episode of 2017.
It is.
We're gonna not post for 2 weeks for Christmas week and New Year's week.
Yeah.
And then we will return on, I'm looking at my calendar right now, January the 9th with our next episode of Good Morning Peoria.
And yeah, we've done, I think, 16 or 17 episodes straight. So you've had us for like 16 weeks now.
Mm-hmm.
We thought we'd give everybody a break.
Yeah, we're
going to
take
weeks.
A couple weeks off and round up. I want to get some more guests in here.
Yes, and if you would like to guest, let us know.
Yes, if you would like to guest, especially even we... Our recording setup is kind of primitive, but I think we've figured out Skype enough. If you would like to guest on an episode, let us know, and we will Skype you in. And absolutely, we're going to get Matt Dale on here pretty soon.
Yes, yes. A friend of mine, Lawrence, who has a fairly popular Twitter, will also be joining us, giving a Brit's opinion. Well, Matt is also a Brit, so we've got two Brits coming up. And we'll have a few other guests in the pipeline, but we're always looking for new ones. And, happy holidays, happy new year, all the best from Project Quantum Leap to you, Fate's Wide Wheel, and we will we'll see you in 2018.
We'll see you next year.
Take care.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. If you enjoyed what you've heard or have any questions or comments, don't be shy. Reach out to us online at fwwquantumleappod.com or Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook at Fate's Wide Wheel. And remember to hit the subscribe button and leave us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you may be listening. Until next time.
Can't see you, man.